This talk is going to be really, well, a physics talk, no math. So, therefore, I should start, as every physics talk starts, with a motivation. Okay. So, our introduction. Now, the subject I'm going to discuss is not very new. It's 30 years old, at least. Yeah. Well, 30 years old, at least. So, I'm not going to, you know, make a list of papers which are relevant. With one exception, my own, from last winter. And that's not because it's the biggest contribution to the subject, it's because that's the last contribution to the subject, which has been published. I'm pretty sure it's not the last one, as you'll see. The motivation for this was some questions about dualities of four-dimensional gauge theories. I think it's a rather important subject, even though it mostly concerns supersymmetric gauge theories. And one of the motivating questions was this one. So there is... we're all familiar with the Montonian-Olev duality, which is the relates n equals 4 superangles with strong and weak coupling. But I'll start with something more complicated and a bit closer to the real world because it has less supersymmetry. So this is the so-called Seiberg duality. So Seiberg duality relates to different n equals 1 supersymmetric gauge theories. And one of them is just a supersymmetric version of QCD. So it has gauge group S, U, and C. And also, so has a corresponding gauge field and superpartners, and also has NF flavors of quarks and NF flavors of anti-quarks, transforming in the NC-dimensional and representation in its dual. So that's a fairly simple theory, and it's asymptotically free, just like ordinary QCD, and it flows to non-trivial, for not too small values of NF, it flows to non-trivial fixed point in the infrared. And the other theory is rather similar. So it also n equals 1, gauge theory. With gauge group like this, which depends both on number of flavors and number of colors in the original theory. And it also has NF quarks and NF anti-quarks, which transform in the fundamental and anti-fundamental representation of the group. And also it's a meson field, which is not charged with respect to this gauge group, the neutral field, but it's an NF by NF matrix, chiral superfield. So two gauge theories, they both flow for appropriate values of NF and NC to a superconformal fixed point in infrared, and the claim of Seiberg duality that actually is the same fixed point. And so this is proposed by Seiberg, and it's still a conjecture. And it seems rather non-trivial that two totally different gauge groups, you know, can lead to the same infrared field theory. And Seiberg argued this by looking at some subset of observables in both theories. And he noticed that observables do match, even though the gauge groups are different. And the point is that you only should look at the gauge invariant combination of the fields. If you only know the gauge invariant combination, it's not so easy to figure out what was the gauge group to begin with. So the gauge group is not observable. That's the main message. And then theories with two totally different gauge groups that can actually be the same in infrared. Now, Seiberg proposed that this duality is actually some sort of non-abelian generalization of the electric magnetic duality for Maxwell theory, different from Montanen-Olev duality. So, but there's not much support for this in the sense that, you know, it's not really clear how do we know that if this duality is electric magnetic in any sense or not. So there is Zyberg's reasoning was the following. So although for this theory it's hard to tell why this deserves to be called electric magnetic duality, there's a related related duality where very similar duality, where the gauge group is SO and similar metric content that is NC dimensional representation for quarks and anti-quarks and then for quarks actually. And then the dual group is again SO group. It's a matter. And in this case it's a bit easier to say it's easy to test the hypothesis that the duality is somehow related to exchange of electric and magnetic charges. Probably the cleanest test of this was proposed, was given by Matt Strassler a few years after the original duality was proposed. So he asked the following question. In this SO gauge theory, there's an interesting observable a trace of holonomy of the gauge field along some loop where R is a spinner representation the gauge group. So it's a non-local observable, but it's gauge invariant. And to ask what's the dual of this under the Zyberg duality, how to describe this observable in the dual language. And he argued rather convincingly that the dual is again some operators smeared over some the same curve, and the dual must carry magnetic flux. So this is sort of this operator is like inserting an infinitely heavy electrically charged source in the spinner representation of the gauge group, and but he argued that the dual is actually insertion of magnetic source. And what this means is that you're supposed to look at some operator called that hoofed operator in the dual theory. And his claim was that this operator, what does it mean, a hoofed operator? It means that, if in four-dimensional space, you can consider S2 sort of linking this curve. So, and the magnetic flux with S2 is non-trivial. The magnetic flux, in this case, just means that the topology of the SON bundle restricted to this little two-sphere is non-trivial. That is, the first Stifel-Whitney class is non-trivial. Second Stifel-Whitney class is non-trivial. So, in this case, this flux takes values in pi 1 of g, which in this case is SO n minus c. And that's z mod 2, so... let's see. So, the dual group. Possible. Sorry. For large enough details, forget about this. Okay, so, this is z mod 2 here, and so there's only one non-trivial value of the for the flux. And the claim is that the spinner representation for the Wilson loop means that then the dual theory must also have this magnetic flux. So there's some argument, not very simple argument, why this should be true. And this supports the claim that this duality is actually electromagnetic duality. Well, what's special about the spinner representation here? Well, that's because here they have massless, in this theory, there are massless quarks in the vector representation. So if you put a vector representation here, it could be screened by massless quarks. This massive source could be screened by massless quarks, but if you put a source in a spin representation, there's no way to screen that. So even from afar, you can detect it. There's a Wilson loop in the spin representation inserted. It's sort of topological, observable in a sense, because you can tell from the topology of the bond, even from afar, that there's something sitting there. Well, and here it's explicitly topological, because the topology of the bond was non-trivial. So in a SO case, it seems clear that the duality has something to do with the electric magnetic duality, at least on this level of the Z2 fluxes. And by analogy, then this must also be somehow, it's a very similar duality, so presumably it's also somehow electric magnetic in some sense. Now, one of my goals was to try to unsolve this, try to actually verify it somehow for this SU gauge theory. Okay. And well, which Wilson loop? There's no analog of spinner. For which gauge group? Why should it vanish? I don't think so. I mean, anyway, that recoupling can be just computed, and it's not in the infrared state. If you look at the values of NF and then see where. I don't see why not. Well, I should vanish. I mean, in similar situations. I'm not sure what this means. Well, anyway, three coupling certainly not zero, and the properties of this theory are very smooth as a change in F ratio and F and NC for how large NF and NC. So, now you can phrase this question a bit differently. You can say, okay, so this theory, well, Seibert explained that sort of the observables, the structural observables, not sort of very sensitive to the structure of the gauge group in the sense that. Actually, gauge invariant observables here, local observables in this theory and this theory are actually the same. One could ask, for example, well, there's certainly a class of observables which does tell us what the gauge group is, namely this one. Just insert here arbitrary representation of the irreducible representation of the gauge group. We'll get a class of gauge invariant observables labeled by this representation in the loop. And if you look, for example, at the OPE, you're going to recover the tensor algebra representations. And, you know, if you know the tensor algebra representations, basically, you can sort of can recover the gauge group. So information about the gauge group is certainly carried by these non-local observables in a fairly explicit way. So you can ask, okay, how can it be that the one gauge, well, then it invents some totally different set of observables here. Because this is called Wilson loops. And Wilson loops for this theory, of course, totally different from Wilson loop in this theory. So if you want to maintain duality, you need to invent some other observables in this theory, which depends on a loop and representation of the dual gauge group. Satisfy the tensor algebra of the dual gauge group. So then another question, what's the dual of this observable? So unfortunately I still don't know the answer to this question because I got sidetracked. And I realized that even for the case of n equals 4 super Young-Mills, where we know that the Montonian order of duality is electric magnetic duality in some sense, this last question wasn't really answered. That is, what is the dual of this operator. Okay. People usually involve the same with mapping local operators. So that's what we're going to talk about. So how to describe the dual of a Wilson loop operator. in an arbitrary representation under Montana knot of duality, and more generally under SL2Z duality. So, and part two of the motivation is has to do again with the understanding better some fine structure of duality. If you look, for example, let's look at n equals 4 supernumeral. So. Yeah, so actually the question, well, is, yeah, it is, in a sense, from the paper, the page number is there. And once you know how it works, and once you know if n equals 4, you can, not for free theory, you can do it for n equals 4, because after all, that's just a marginal deformation of Maxwell's theory. So, it's a bit less trivial than Abelian case, but still, it's certainly an answerable question. And also pretty kinematic question, so we'll discuss. So not much dynamics is involved in answering this question. So the other, well, questions have to do with this Montanian order of duality. And this duality relates here with gauge groups, say, involves two different theories with gauge groups G and Langlands dual of G. And actually, well, I'm going to, if I'm working on R4, flat space, then I really should be labeling the gauge theories with Lie algebras, not that, because the Lie group doesn't really matter. So if you exchange the Lie algebra G and the Langlands dual, the algebra G. And you can ask, okay, so how can I actually understand, well, how to actually prove this duality? And in the cases in low dimensions where like in, say, Sine-Gordon Thiering duality, you can explicitly construct the operators which created of the dual, well, which are elementary from the point of view of dual theory, and then show that they satisfy the equations of motion of the dual theory. So this is, here it's not really possible to do, because, you know, if you look at the simple operators here, they're not gauge invariant, and they won't be representable by any nice operators in this theory, okay, because the G invariance is not realized here at all. So there are two options. Either you're going to embed both of these theories into some bigger theory which has both this and this gauge invariance as subgroups, and then by some gauge fixing you can show that maybe it reaches to this or this. Or you can just work with only gauge invariant observables. Seems a bit harder, but since we know what they are. So, and then, for example, if you start with, say, some quark in the adjoint representation, there's no other relation here. So, some gauge invariant, but if you you can construct something more gauge invariant by, say, considering quark, anti-quark, well, connected by some adjoint Wilson loop, Wilson line. Okay, and then we'd like to understand how to represent the same operator in this theory. So therefore, we're really interested in not only mapping this sort of Wilson loop, but also Wilson lines with some quarks attached, arbitrary representation. So like adjoint in this case. So this is the motivation part. The usual answer to the question, what's the dual of the Wilson loop, is that the dual is the Atwoof loop operator. And what it means is that you have some operator defined by the condition, well, usually you write operators as some function of fundamental fields, but the Atwoof loop operator is defined differently. It's explained by Atwoof in 78, maybe, or something, maybe 75, a long time ago. So you can define disorder operators in gauge theories by specifying, so by saying the gauge field has some sort of singularity. And the way he described it is by saying that the gauge field has non-trivial topology on this two-sphere linking this curve. In the case of, say, gauge group SU, well, if the Lie algebra is, well, so if all the fields are in the adjoint, the gauge group is really SUN mod ZN, and then you can contemplate non-trivial flux taken with, well, the topology of the gauge field in a two-sphere is non-trivial, can be non-trivial only if pi 1 is non-trivial for the gauge group. So it tells us to look at this, which is Z mod N. So we have this Z mod N valued flux in a two-sphere, and this sort of classifies topology of the gauge fields in a R4 with a circle or closed curve Xi. This is the where the Hooft magnetic flux takes values, and this operator is then according to Hooft classified by this guy. From the starting point the starting observation is the following. So this topological condition doesn't really specify completely the singularity of the gauge field around this, or in the neighborhood of this curve. And actually, if you look at Hooft's paper, when he tries to compute something with his operators, he actually assumes something for the singularity of the gauge field near this curve, instead of just saying that topology is given by this. He doesn't really justify that. He just says, well, it can be shown that probably that's the most suitable asymptotics, but he nevertheless uses it. And so let's be more systematic about it. Let's see what sort of singularities are actually allowed here. Okay. And we'll find that the singularities are labeled precisely by representations of the Langlands dual Lie algebra. Okay. So the math part of the analysis actually is not new, as you will see in a second. So I want to understand singularities in the gauge fields, singularities which take values in if take R4, Xi is a curve, and then if you look in the microscope, well, every curve looks like a straight line, so just look at the neighborhood of this smooth curve, so this just means that we have R4 minus a line. So you want to look at what kind of singularities we can allow for the gauge fields. Now, of course, all kinds of singularities can allow a lot of freedom, but we want to construct this sort of the dual of the Wilson loop, and so we should put some constraint requirements of symmetry. So the Wilson loop operator, it's kind of remarkable because it doesn't break many symmetries. Well, of course, the fact that you have a straight line R4 already breaks some symmetry, but the Wilson loop doesn't really break any other symmetries beyond those broken by this geometric line. So what are the symmetries? Well, let's assume that we're working in conformal field theory. Anyway, operators are best defined in the ultraviolet. If in a sensible field theory, the ultraviolet limit is a conformal field theory. So we're going to then assume in addition that we're in the CFT. But anyway, that's a suitable thing for n equals 4 subgranules. So what are the symmetries? Well, one of the symmetries, it's very convenient to map this place where the singularity occurs to infinity. That's kind of standard trick in two-dimensional CFT when you do radial quantization. Also convenient here, so makes symmetry more explicit. So the metric you start with is written in cylindrical coordinates. This one. Well, I assume in four dimensions. So and then if you want to map them, well, you can do a while rescaling by dividing everything by R squared. Then you get this, and that's a metric on the Poincaré metric on the upper half plane. Also, it goes under the name of Euclidean ADS2, and this is S2. Okay. Really, the symmetry we want to preserve is the isometry of the space ADS2 cross S2. So we want to preserve SL2R cross SL3 symmetry. So if you want to understand gauge fields, we want to understand singularities in the gauge fields which are, on R4 minus line, which preserve the symmetry. Or if you prefer, in terms of, if you work on ADS2 cross S2, you want to consider boundary conditions for gauge fields on ADS2 cross S2, which are compatible with this symmetry. There may be other fields in the theory besides the gauge fields, like they're all the super partners of the vector multiplet. For the most part, I'm going to assume that the operators in addition preserve supersymmetry. The conditions for other fields are going to be fixed by those for the gauge fields. Or might this field just require all the other fields to be non-singular, so then I'm going to get a sort of non-supersymmetric analog of the Wilson loop or a Hooft loop. So what are the singularities then? Well, so we should start with the Maxwell theory. Let's turn off the gauge coupling. So I'm just going to have a Abelian gauge theory. Well, first of all, let's look at the usual Wilson loop. After all, Wilson loop is also a loop operator. Well, in the usual definition, just say we insert a Wilson loop in the path integral. Okay. But if you actually look what the gauge fields do in the presence of the Wilson loop, you'll see that they cannot be non-singular. Okay, so actually the fields have singularity if you insert a Wilson loop. Namely, for example, the saddle point, if you insert the operator for charge and Wilson loop in the Abelian gauge theory, then the saddle point on which the path integrals are localized is a singular gauge field configuration, is a Maxwell, it's a Coulomb field, which so the curvature 2 form of the is this. So really, even when inside the Wilson loop, it should allow for in the path integral, it should allow for gauge fields to have singularities about this line. So what does it mean for the gauge field itself? It just means that you allow basically allow free boundary condition for the gauge field that is near the singularity. Near the boundary of ADS2, the gauge fields can have this asymptotic plus less singular terms. It's natural not to fix this thing. This coefficient is going to be free, and it's going to be sort of localized. Well, it's going to be determined by varying the action, including this term you added, and then you can determine the classical this value of another determined by requiring the variation of the action vanish, including the boundary terms in the action and also this piece. So, incidentally, since the gauge field is allowed to be singular at this point in this line, or in other words, I have this asymptotic in ADS2, actually this guy is not particularly well defined because here you evaluate A exactly on this line. So it should regularize a bit just by moving off a bit this locus sort of averaging over all directions. Its technical point. Now this is the sort of how to describe Wilson loop, and then that hooped loop, that is magnetic Wilson loop, is also easily described. So in that hooped loop case, called HM, so you will you will not allow A to have this form. You will require A to be non-singular on this line. Okay. A in the t direction. But you will allow the singularity in different directions. You will say that you will say that the gauge field on the two sphere has a fixed flux as you approach to the boundary. And also, if you want spherical symmetry, there has to be just the volume form of S2. So this form is basically unique. Well, okay. So this is the fixed basically by rotational invariance and conformal invariance. Simple as that. So in this case, F does not have components along ADS2. It only has components along S2 and near the boundary. So if you prefer Euclidean coordinates, then you get that the curvature 2 form is the usual curvature 2 form for the Dirac monopole of strength M. Near R equals 0. So we just define that hooked operator in the Maxwell theory just by saying that the gauge field is singular, and this is the kind of singularity we allow. That is, the most singular piece is spherically symmetric, and the less singular can do whatever it wants. And now you can compute expectation values of other operators, normal operators, in the presence of this guy, just in the usual way. Just do the usual path integral, just impose this boundary condition at this point. Like you can, for example, evaluate the expectation values of the stress energy tensor or something like that in the presence of this guy. Interestingly, all these expectation values depend on the theta angle of the Maxwell theory. And, so it's not terribly surprising in a sense because it's just another manifestation of the Witten effect. The point is that, the theta term is this one. And usually just drop it in the Maxwell theory if you work on R4 because, it's just total derivative. But of course, here the total derivative also picks terms which are terms from the neighborhood of this line which you excise. So actually, it's not a trivial thing. So for example, when you find a saddle point, this piece, variation of this piece will contribute something to the boundary variation. So in the end, expectation values do depend on the theta angle. So, of course, we can consider also mixed boundary conditions. This is like a fixed boundary condition for the Hooft operator. This is like a free one, Neumann one, and you can consider mixed ones as well. You can allow the gauge field to have some components in ADS2 as you approach the point r equals to zero, as well as on S2, and on S2 it's fixed to be that. So you can have then operators labeled by two integers, n and m. Okay. And you can compute a tweak coupling, it's a Gaussian theory, you can compute this theory, say expectation values of other operators in the presence of this. And the answer in general depends on the theta angle. And in particular, you can explicitly see the SL2Z duality of the Maxwell theory. Okay. Now, let me turn on to the non-abelian gauge theory. So, I won't discuss the Wilson loop case because it's very similar to the abelian case. Rather, I want to explain how I'm going to define magnetic Wilson loops at weak coupling. So I'm just again going to require the curvature to be singular in a way which in such a way that it only has components along the S2 part. Plus, it has to be spherically symmetric. It is SO3 invariant and also SL2R invariant. That completely fixes what the singular part looks like. And it should look like that. Again. Where B is a covariantly constant section of the adjoint bundle so in the abelian case it's just a number. Well, if you assume that topology is trivial, then B is basically just an element of the Lie algebra. Okay. So in the absence of topological topology, it's a Lie algebra element. Now, there's some constraints on this B. This was first shown by Goddard, Newton, and Olive also a long time ago. They looked at the problem which is identical to this one mathematically. They looked at classification of gauge fields, which are spherically symmetric and sort of have the scale invariance. So they looked at the classification sort of at infinity. So they wanted this field to asymptote to this at infinity. Well, actually, I want to be near zero. But mathematically, the problem is identical, and they say that B is quantized, which means the following, that exponentially you get identity in your Lie group. And the reason for this is fairly simple. If you have this, if you know magnetic field, you can compute, compute holonomy around any loop. And like this. So let's fix the point in a two-sphere and compute holonomy around various loops. Okay. And turns out that the holonomy is given by this Lie group element. Where capital omega is the area of this piece of the sphere to the left of the curve. And now, so for every loop, you get an element of the Lie group. Now, at first, loops are small, and get larger, then they shrink again to a point. So for any sequence of loops, you get a path in the group. But actually, this path is supposed to be a loop. So it should begin at identity and also end at identity, because in the end, the loops again shrinks to trivial loops. So therefore, for when this guy is equal to 4 pi, it's supposed to get identity again, and that means that this condition must be satisfied. Okay. Now, with that hooped flux is basically the... Well, so any such sequence gives you a loop in the group G, and that hooped flux would correspond actually to the homotopy class of that loop. Okay. So while this B something carries something more, it actually tells you about something about the actual loop, not just homotopy class. Now, also B is also defined modulo the gauge transformation. So modulo constant gauge transformation. So using this freedom, you can rotate B to any chosen Cartan subalgebra. And then, so let's assume that B belongs to the Cartan subalgebra of your Lie algebra. And then this B then is going to be an element of the Cartan subalgebra satisfying this condition and define modulo the Weyl group, which is the residual gauge symmetry you're left. This is the answer then of Goddard, Nuis, and Olive for the classification of this sort of gauge fields. They're classified by elements of some lattice in the Cartan subalgebra, lattice defined by this condition, and modulo the Weyl group. Now, this lattice can be written in sort of more convenient way. So, this condition. Well, let's assume that the gauge group is sort of the adjoint gauge group. So so its center is trivial. In that case, the condition is the same as the condition that the value of any root on this Lie algebra element is integer. So in other words, this B takes values in the dual of the root lattice. The dual of the root lattice is called a co-weight lattice of the Lie algebra. And it's supposed to divide by the Weyl group. Group. So so this lattice, by the way, has a sublattice called co-root lattice. And the quotient of this lattice by this lattice is precisely where that hooked magnetic flux takes values, the original one, the one which is in pi 1 of the this gauge group. Okay. So, but the actual magnetic charge, not the topological one, takes values in this lattice, modulo the Weyl group. Okay. So, next I'd like to, so this determines the asymptotics of the gauge field, and if you impose some, say, supersymmetry, it also fixes the asymptotics for all other fields in the theory, like n equals 4 superdiagonals, for example. If you have some fundamental matter fields, you have to also consider various possibilities for those. So this is just analysis for the gauge fields. Okay, so once you have this definition of the hooked operator, you can just go ahead and compute with it at weak coupling, because this asymptotics, well, you just know which gauge fields to integrate over, and you can, say, compute expectation values of stress energy tensors and current in the presence of this loop. Okay. Now, let me discuss next issue. So how do we generalize this to the case of both electric and magnetic charge? One issue. Okay, sorry, I forgot to mention one thing. So of course, the co-weight lattice of G is the same as by definition, basically, is the weight lattice of the Langlands dual with the algebra. The well group is the same. So, and this set, of course, is classifies a useful representation of the Langlands dual with the algebra. So for this reason, we see that magnetic charges, magnetic Wilson loops are classified by representation of the Langlands dual. Okay. Now I'd like to understand how to classify mixed dionic operators. So, in the paper you can find example of computation with this definition, say computation of some expression with a stress energy tensor in the presence of this loop at weak coupling. So now we're going to have this sort of mixed Wilson at hooked operators. How are we going to classify those? So the very very naive guess would be, well, we're going to have electric representation for the group G, well, maybe the algebra, because I'm working with Lie algebras, and maybe magnetic representation for the Langlands dual Lie algebra. That cannot work. That's a naive guess. Cannot work. And a very simple argument that it's the wrong answer is that you're supposed to be with a symmetry in the theory which shifts the theta angle by 2 pi. So and we know that it should act non-trivially on these labels. So in the abelian case, we know how it acts. So if you have electric and magnetic charges, which are just integers, in the abelian case, this maps to like this. Okay. So, and naturally, we'll sort of tensor this guy, right? In the non-abelian case, we'd say that we want to replace the electric one, the tensor of electric one, with magnetic one. Of course, this cannot be right because it's not a group operation. Tensoring representation of the algebra is not a group operation. It cannot take the inverse, and this is supposed to be a group operation. You can also shift it back, right? So that's bad. Now, the actual answer is this one, that the labels that take values in the weight lattice of Lie algebra and so the label takes values in the direct sum of weight and co-weight lattices of the Lie algebra. Okay. And then you're supposed to identify these labels by the action of the Weyl group. Okay. So there is only one Weyl group, even though there are two groups in the game, sort of dual and G and Langlands dual of G. So if it's quotient only by one Weyl group. And then with this definition, there is a reasonable action of this T transformation, namely, okay, I'll show it later. So how do we actually reach this conclusion? So why is the labeling of this dionic operators like that? Well, suppose we have non-trivial magnetic flux. Suppose this B is non-trivial. So then the gauge field is required to be non-trivial, actually singular near our loop. And it actually breaks the gauge group, okay? So it's intuitively obvious and can be argued more rigorously that therefore the electric charge you can also attach must be a representation of the unbroken gauge group, the one broken by the magnetic field, okay? Now, we should take values in the, so if you work, if you translate to weights, means that mu should belong to the, well, she takes values in the weight lattice of the subalgebra of the Lie algebra G unbroken, which leaves B unbroken, that is, commutes with B. Now, well, actually, it's the same one. However, the while group is different. You see, B also breaks on while group. So, really should be doing this, well, physically what you should do is the following. You should take first B, modulo the while group, and B leaves in the co-weightlet. And you should take mu on top of that. Define modulo the action of the unbroken while group. That is, the while group which leaves a subgroup of the while, well, the stabilizer of this B. Okay. But of course, it's the same as just taking these two guys in quotient by the whole combined action of the while group on both, because, you know, first you quotient by the full while group, and then after you fix B, then you quotient this guy mu by the residual one. So that's what this operators are labeled by. Now, so this labels completely fix the singularity in the gauge fields near the insertion line. Okay. In principle, allows you to compute a quick coupling. So, you know, if B is non-zero, then a quick coupling, you won't receive these guys here. So the excitation values won't be sensitive to leading order to what the electric representation was, only fill the magnetic one. But at high orders, both will enter. Now I want to discuss how the S-duality group is realized. So, as we know, that there is some conjectured SL2Z action for any closed-field superangles, which acts on the gauge coupling. And the gauge coupling is usually combined with the theta angle into this complexified gauge coupling, and then the generators of SL2Z just gonna like this supported on the coupling, and under this coupling the gauge theory is supposed to remain invariant provided the operators are mapped appropriately. And people usually focus on operators which actually don't map at all on the invariant one, say the moduli of the Coulomb branch. They're not acted upon by this transformation at all. Now, from the abelian theory, we know that these guys are going to be acted upon, because this transformation, you know, this transformation is just a shift of the theta angle, and that shifts the magnetic, so the electric charge by the magnetic charge. Well, this one is electric magnetic duality, and should exchange the two labels. Okay? Depends, I guess, how we define the module. Okay. I'll give you the final. Yeah. Okay. So, now we need to figure out how these guys transform on the SL2Z, if they do at all, actually. We need to figure out whether this group acts reasonably on this pairs module, this while group. Okay. Now, actually, for the T transformation, you can just deduce how it acts, because this is a perturbative symmetry. You can see it as weak coupling and shift the theta angle. The point is that the effect of this term, one should be able to show that the effect of this term at theta equals to 2 pi is precisely the same as the effect of having extra electric charge. Okay? And it's not very hard to show with this definition that indeed, when I have singularity in the magnetic field, this guy acts as an additional, this guy acts as a boundary term, and this boundary term is precisely the contribution of the Wilson loop, whose charge is determined by this magnetic field. Okay? So that's actually the usual Witten effect. One can deduce how it works, and the answer is the following. So, to write the answer, I first need to fix some metrics. See, in my description, I did not identify the Lie algebra in the dual, The Lie algebra is dual vector space, and anyway, I didn't fix the normalization of the metric, so it's convenient to fix it now, and I'm going to fix it by saying that have this core roots H alpha so if you choose a metric, you can map elements in the Cartan subalgebra to its dual, so and vice versa. So the star denotes this map. So alpha lives in the dual of the Cartan subalgebra. So alpha star lives in the Cartan subalgebra itself. So these are H alphas then are core roots, and they live in the Cartan subalgebra. And then we'll normalize so that the short core roots has core length 2. If you wish, long roots have length squared 2. And this fixes what this map star is. Okay. And then the transformation under T, so under tau goes to tau plus 1, one can show that one has to map also this pair mu b to mu plus b star. Okay. So one can easily check this is a well-defined map in the sense that B lives in the wet, in the lattice defined by this condition, mu lives in the lattice defined by this condition. And you can check that, you know, if you add to mu this B star, this guy still satisfies this condition. Okay. There's a well-defined action. Situation a bit more problematic for arbitrary Lie algebra. Situation a bit more problematic with other transformation. Okay. Well, first of all, we can't derive how the operator transformed, because this is actually a conjecture that there's a symmetry here as well. Okay. You can just guess a reasonable transformation law. But once you fix T, there's not much choice for how S can act, you know. Because right, you can also do so then, yeah. Right. Well, yeah, neither.
Unless you are taking some pairs which are fixed by something.
Well, I mean, for generic indeed, but in general, yeah, B doesn't have to break the schedule completely, right? So, anyway, once you know, you want to get a solve to this, so that your choice. Okay. So, anyway, the only reasonable transformation law would be this one. It seems. Let's look for simplicity. I'm looking at simplicity for the case of Lie algebra, which is self-dual, since everything except, you know, a BC system. So, don't want to complicate the discussion. So, this could be a reasonable thing. Actually, that's the only thing which would, together with this would generate a cell to Z. Actually, this doesn't work. Well, this does satisfy, as you already know, the second condition. But mu star does not satisfy this one in general. It only satisfies if the gauge Lie algebra is released. Okay. So in general, the value of there's some, you know, for short roots, the value of mu star on a short root can be, you know, fractional. So this is not a well-defined action. Forget about it. Yeah. However, if you call this S transformation, you can still concoct something which does make sense. If you look at this combination, so this would map mu b to minus mu like this. Now q is, well, q chosen appropriately, if it's some integer, then that saves the day. You know, it's mu star, it causes problem because it gives you a fractional answer to the integer, as you want here. But if you multiply by a large enough integer, this you won't have a problem. Okay? And namely, well, for simply list, actually, there's no problem at all. For the works. For the self-dual non-simply laced Lie algebras F4 and G2, you have to choose Q equals to 2 or Q equals to 3. Well, okay, yeah, so, right, precisely. So this like for self to Z doesn't act in case of F4 and G2, but some subgroup does, okay? The subgroup is known as gamma naught of Q.
Everything would go right if you interpret the right hand side
to the set of weights for the self to Z doesn't act, but the subgroup of self to Z does act. There's no other group, there's only F4. There's no F4 prime or whatever. There's no way to see all these operators are allowed. You're supposed to map all of them. And you can't. The S doesn't map them. There's no action of S, okay? Now that's actually not quite the end of the story. Because this would mean that tau goes to -1 over, well, this is what's usually called strongly coupling duality. So if this guy is not in the duality group, then what's going on? So something is wrong here, right? So what does it mean that the... So then usually people say that the strong coupling limit of n equals 4 superangulars is a weakly coupled gauge theory described by dual group, which for F4 and G2 will mean the same angles. There's no other F4. Now, we should have concluded this guy doesn't act. Well, the actual answer turns out to be that the correct transformation is actually this one. Okay, this is the standard normalization that I chose. So for F4 and G2 is a bit different than what the naive one. And actually then, for this guy, there is an additional action, well, there's a sort of analog of S, which acts a bit differently from this naive law. Okay, and the actual geometry group is not a cell to Z, but some subgroup of a cell to R, whose intersection with cell to Z is this guy. So actually this was noted before by Dory, Fraser, Hollowood, and Kneipp in 96. And they argue that looking at non-abelian monopoles, which is a bit, it's mathematically equivalent to this one, but this is more precise because it just works with observables. The only way to map observables is by looking at this. So there's no SL to Z, but there is some other subgroup called the Hecke subgroup. Okay. Now, I'd like to outline some further developments with this. So we have a workable definition of Wilson, or mixed Wilson and Hooft operators, magnetic Wilson loops, so Wilson and Hooft operators. At three coupling, we can compute with them. And now, what can actually compute? Well, there's one very important computation, which I don't know how to do, despite the definition to be here. And this is the question. In the beginning, I talked about the tensor algebra representation. It's a rather non-trivial fact, if it's indeed a fact, that that Hooft operators, the way defined, actually obey this tensor algebra. So the question is really how to compute the OP of two Hooft operators. Because the way they are labeled by the right set, but the set is defined in terms of this highest weights of representation, not representations themselves. So it's not clear how the actual tensor law is going to appear from just colliding two singularities. No, there's not a... It's not topology. For SUN, for example, is not interesting topology. The label is not topological. So the topological label lives in the quotient of this guy in the coweight. Takes a element in the coweight. It's like two adjoints. No, it lives in the coweight lattice. Okay, I'm talking about... Okay, let's take... I guess the chamber terminology. So this magnetic Wilson loops labeled by elements in the coweight lattice. So, yeah, but then there's no issue because there are no representations, just elements of the pi 1 of G. So that is trivial, of course. Now I want to see how to. Yeah, okay. Right. So Yeah, I'd like to understand how to reproduce. It's actually an interesting test of S-duality that does define the duals of Wilson loops actually do obey the right tensor algebra. It's a highly non-trivial test also. Not obvious from the definition. Now let me mention some other things you can do with these operators. Well, first of all, you can go to lower supersymmetry and actually address this issue of, in the context of cyborg duality, what's the dual of the Wilson loop. So I'm thinking about it currently. And so far, no progress. So that's, you're welcome to think about it too. Another issue is to understand what Wilson loops can, well, at hook loops, well, magnetic Wilson loops can end on. So far, we're looking at a little piece. So what can they end on? So how do we describe the end point? In some cases, for example, suppose, here's a simple thing. Let's look at the case of Suzy QCD, for example. And let's look at the case of Wilson loops in the fundamental representation. Their topologicals are trivial, so they can end on something. They can end on quarks in the fundamental and the fundamental. Now, what's the analog of, but nevertheless, if you end it on a quark, the quark does carry flavor numbers. So the end point is not just nothing. It always is flavor charged. Yeah? That's because all the fields in the fundamental are flavor charged. So the question is, how do you see it in the dual? You can ask this question in a similar context, in a simpler context with more supersymmetry. For example, if you look at n equals 2 super Young mills, the gauge group SU2 plus 4 flavors of fundamentals. This theory has S duality very similar to that n equals 4 super Young mills, as argued by Seiberg and Witten. So in this theory, they are not topologically non-trivial magnetic Wilson loop operators because the gauge group is simply connected. Nevertheless, you can look at the simple case. Let's look at the Wilson loop, the quark and antiquark. You can terminate the Wilson loop in the fundamental by ending it on a quark or antiquark, and the endpoints are going to carry flavor quantum numbers. Then in the dual, what's the dual description of that? Well, actually, in this theory, the fundamental Wilson loop is mapped to the adjoint magnetic Wilson loop, as we can show. But what are the endpoints? So this should be the dual quarks. So it's very important to understand that. And the simplest thing you can try to understand is why is that the endpoints carry non-trivial flavor quantum numbers. So here, the flavor group here is SO8, so that's spin8. These guys must be in the vector of SO8. The S duality acts non-trivially on this spin representation. Actually, the dual of the statement is that the magnetic Wilson loop in the adjoint must terminate on something which carries spin representation of the spin 8 group. So how do we show that? Okay. So I have some ideas about that. It's not so hopeless. So. A question here, one way to reform is the following. You can screen. The point is that you can end this issue about screening. You can screen fundamental Wilson line by a quark, okay, in the fundamental, and that's why how you basically know that the endpoint must be the must carry flavor quantum numbers. Here we have the adjoint magnetic Wilson loop. So what can you screen it by? Okay. Well, the obvious answer is with a monopole. Okay. Now, this is kind of a bit strange because let's look at the Coulomb branch where the situation is clear. Monopole is a big, fat object. How on earth are you going to screen a singularity in the gauge? It seems like even if you put monopole right on top of it, it's not going to screen anything. The answer is actually very interesting. On the Coulomb branch, I sort of understand how it works. The point is that if you take this big, fat object on the Coulomb branch, it's actually a BPS situation. You have a BPS, you can choose this guy to BPS. Have a point like magnetic source in the adjoint, you have a BPS monopole here. You can ask, actually, what happens if you try to put the BPS monopole, the Polyakov monopole, into this sort of singular Dirac-like monopole, which is point-like? The answer is actually it shrinks to zero size if you bring it close. So if there's no explicit solution for this, for the gauge field in this case, although it doesn't seem to be very hard to obtain, But you can argue indirectly from the knowledge of the moduli space that as you bring this guy closer, it shrinks, and eventually the configuration becomes purely abelian. So it completely cancels this guy. Okay. So this is the station of the Coulomb branch. And since we know that BPS monopoles carry spinner representation of spin 8, we sort of know how the screen works in the Coulomb branch. But this is station of the Coulomb branch. What I would like to really understand how it works right in the origin of the Coulomb branch, where there's no massive monopole and stuff like that. We should be able to see just purely perturbative. Okay. And the last issue I'd like to mention is that this magnetic Wilson-Wolf observable is kind of important for topological versions of Young-Mills. So n equals 4 super Young-Mills has three topological twists which are inequivalent. So the sort of Donaldson-like twist. Waffer-Witten twist. And the twist first considered by Marcus, I think. And Wilson-Wolf observables do not descend to topological observables. They don't commit with the BRST operators for this guy or for this guy. And neither do these magnetic Wilson-Wolfs. But they do survive this twist. So these become topological observables. You can study some version of this in this topological twisted theory. Station is actually kind of interesting. In this theory, there are two different... When you do the twisting, what happens is the following. You have field phi, which is a superpartner of the gauge field. Well, there's six component field, so it becomes, after the twist, four vector, and then two scalars. Okay. So the topological Wilson observable is basically this. The holonomy of A plus I phi, or I mu plus I phi mu. But the fact that it's topological means that the expectation value of this guy is going to be independent of the shape of the contour or whatnot. It can deform completely without changing expectation values. This was noted previously in a bit more limited context when people studied BPS Wilson-Wolf observables. For some reason, they were considered the case when the C lies in the hyperplane, in the R4, but actually it can be anything. Okay. Moreover, the expectation values actually of several of these guys is going to be completely independent of location or anything like that. So. Okay. Now this is sort of the electric observables, but you should probably assume that there should be some magnetic thing. And this is the BPS version of the set Hooft magnetic Wilson loop operator, labeled by the dual labels. Okay. Now station actually is very interesting. In this theory, there are two BRST charges, not one. And you can choose any linear combination to be the BRST charge you want. And depending on this coefficient, only some loop operators survive. For one value of the coefficient, only Wilson loop survives. For another value, only magnetic Wilson loops. So SDR actually is non-trivial on this set of topological theories, and it maps on this excellent parameter one. It actually maps different class of observables into each other. Okay. And this aspect actually plays an important role. For example, it emerged in discussions with Ed Witten that it provides a physical interpretation of the Langlands geometric Langlands correspondence. So I'll stop here. If you look carefully at Waffer's paper, you'll see that what he proves is not that tau goes to minus 1 over tau with the symmetry, but this is a symmetry for F4 and G2. So actually it's not, it follows indirectly. One thing which also follows from this filter consideration, which I'm not sure how to extract from Waffer's paper, is that this element, visual case, well, this must be combined with some rotation in the Coulomb branch. otherwise it won't be symmetry at all. Okay, not sure how to see that from the string theory description. So basically, this must be component sort of a square root of a wild transformation for a four integer tuple. Well, in there, the normalization of the metric is different a bit, so you don't need to. Well, you can talk about the group. Well, SL2Z is probably not the right language. You know. It's not a duality group acting on one theory. SX relates different theories. Thank you.